Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. Now we go to our friend Reza Marashi. He's at the National Iranian American Council. That's NIACouncil.org. And what they do is they push for peace between the U.S. and Iran. And I'm down with that. Welcome back to the show. Reza, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
And by the way, I never get this right in your introduction. Could you please tell us what was the name of your job when you worked in the U.S. State Department?
Yeah, I worked in the Office of Iranian Affairs at the U.S. Department of State, you know, covering a range of issues everywhere from democracy, human rights, internal politics, foreign policy, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, right on. I like to remind people that, remind myself. It's very good. Okay, so now here's the thing of it, a little bit of background. They made, hallelujah, unbelievable. This is a major step. I don't think anybody could really overstate it. Maybe I could, but most people couldn't overstate the importance of the fact that last November, the Americans and the rest of the UN Security Council, including the permanent members and including Germany, the P5 plus one, they struck a deal with the Iranians that said, here's our interim deal toward working toward a final deal. But in the meantime, while we're working on our final deal, you will do these steps and we will do those steps and all of that. So now that's been last November. Here we are. It's the beginning of June. We're nearing the point where they're supposed to be able to come up with a kind of final deal here. So I was hoping that you could give the audience a brief rundown. What was the deal, basically, in not too small of a nutshell, but what was the interim deal? How well it's being implemented now? Any discrepancies or crises we need to know about? And then I hope we can get into talking about the final deal, its probable shape, and the probabilities that it will take shape at all.
Well, sure. I think the important things to point out about the interim nuclear deal that was signed in November and went into implementation in January, there's two points on both sides that I think are important to point out, one side being the United States, or the P5 plus one, as you pointed out, and the other side being Iran. On the U.S. or P5 plus one side, they were able to give Iran some sanctions relief. I think a total of a couple of billion dollars over the next 6 months, over the six-month duration of the interim deal. But more important than the sanctions relief was that they finally acknowledged that if a final comprehensive nuclear deal is struck, there will be enrichment on Iranian soil. And what that enrichment of uranium on Iranian soil will look like will be mutually defined, they said. And that was a pretty big shift because neither the Bush administration nor Obama in his first term were willing to go that far. And I think that's something that the Iranians were able to sink their teeth into. Now, on the Iranian side, they obviously made some very significant limitations to the nuclear program that they have. For example, they stopped enriching uranium to the 20% level. Very difficult to go from 0% to 20%. Much easier to go from 20% to 90%, which would be needed for a weapon should Iran in the future decide to make that decision. They haven't since 2003, according to U.S. intelligence. And the other thing that they did is they diluted the stockpile of 20% enriched uranium, meaning they had a stockpile of a certain number of kilograms, and that stockpile is going to be reduced to zero in about a month and a half's time, if not already. So that's significant. That means you take something that the United States and its allies viewed as a proliferation risk, and you further reduce that risk because the actual concrete, tangible items that Iran has in its nuclear program have been significantly reduced. There were other details, on both sides, but just so the listeners get an idea of what the real meat on the bones was, I think those things were the most important.
Mm. All right, so now a couple of things here. First of all, it is... Well, yeah, let's go back over what you say about how important it is that the Americans have said, I guess they haven't really yet, but in effect, they have accepted enrichment by saying that they will accept enrichment. And at best, really, since the beginning of the Obama administration, they've implied that they would accept enrichment, but they never have outright said that. And so that really is a big deal. I could see why that would be a real big deal to the Iranians. But then am I right that they're really far apart on just how many centrifuges, will remain spinning under the New Deal, or limits on the expansion of new facilities or anything like that? It seems like there's a lot of ground to be made up there.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one way of putting it. Another way of putting it is they're negotiating. And any two parties that are sitting down to negotiate, whether it's the P5 plus one in Iran or two businessmen or anyone in between, you know, they're going to start out with their respective maximalist positions, meaning, you know, if you had a gymnasium, let's say, for example, the United States would be at one end of the gymnasium, Iran would be at the other end of the gymnasium. The idea is that through the course of negotiations, you meet at half court. So that way, you're making compromises. Both sides get more than they would get without any kind of compromise, but neither side gets everything that they want. But through compromising and getting a little bit more than you would get otherwise, that's better than the alternative, the status quo, which is moving both sides to the precipice of war. And I think that's something that both sides would independently seek to avoid. So, you know, between now and July 20th, which is the soft deadline, which they hope to get this all done by, there's going to be a lot of posturing. There's going to be a lot of blame game, a lot of spin, trying to shape the narrative in the media about, you know, who's more at fault or who needs to compromise more. You're already seeing that in the United States, and I think you're going to start to see it more in Iran. But at the end of the day, the moral of the story is both sides have to compromise in order for this to work. Both sides think that they're approaching this from a position of strength. The reality is that neither side is as strong as they think they are. And over time, I think they've slowly started to realize that, but not quite enough that's necessary to get the deal. And I think that's what the next month to month and a half is really going to be about, is kind of like a game of chicken, where, you know, those old James Dean movies where two cars are driving towards the end of the cliff to see who hits the brakes first.
Yeah.
That's basically what they're doing now in this negotiation. But neither side wants this to fail.
Yeah. Well, now, so here's the thing about it, is that all these guys remind me of used car salesmen, so I'm cool with them negotiating. And it seems like, well, you know, I don't know. When the discrepancy between the number of centrifuges each side will agree to is that vast, I'm perfectly, you know, I'm totally cool with, okay, well, here's where we're going to have our major compromise. This is really the crux of the issue anyway. But then the Americans go bringing up missiles. Missiles for nuclear bombs that aren't being made, and that we're completely diminishing. The whole goal here is to diminish even the possibility of an Iranian nuclear weapons threat to such a degree that we'll be willing to lift our sanctions and maybe even begin to get along in other ways, maybe. And yet, we got to bring up missiles. Is that just more used car salesmanship? And now the damn music's playing and we got to go to break. Hang on 1 second, Reza. We'll be right back, everybody. It's Reza Marashi from NIAcouncil.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. All right, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. It's the Scott Horton Show. We're on Liberty Radio Network at LRN.FM and at ScottHorton.org. Join up the chat room, ScottHorton.org/chat. We're talking with Reza Marashi. He's formerly with the U.S. State Department, the Iran desk there, as you heard him say. And now he's at the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org there with Trita Parsi and others doing great work pushing for peace between the U.S. and Iran, a real detente between the U.S. and Iran, and thank goodness for that. And so now, what I was trying to say, and I was overly explaining the hell out of it, Rez, but I was just saying, wheeling and dealing is one thing, and arguing over the numbers, spinning centrifuges is one thing, but I'm worried, and I'm channeling a little Gareth Porter here, I'm worried that the demands that, oh yeah, now you have to bring your missiles up for negotiation too, is a poison pill, that this is sabotage, that this is sort of like 2005, where now they're going to blow up the damn deal. Right when they could have a deal, they're going to blow up their own deal for whatever stupid political reasons here, rather than do the right thing and finally end this stupid Cold War. But I know you're more optimistic than that, so let's hear it. Talk me down.
Well, I think that there are some in the United States and Europe that do want to put missiles on the table. Israel and Saudi Arabia, I'm sure, want to do the same. But there are enough smart people in all of those places that have articulated very clearly that if you don't have the fissile material produced by enriching uranium to put into a missile, then ballistic missiles are not a non-proliferation threat. They're not a nuclear weapons threat. They're not a delivery system for a nuclear weapon if you don't actually have the material to put into the missile. So in the bigger scheme of things, while there are some people that are making that argument that they should be on the table, and the United States has brought up the issue in the negotiations, you know, Tehran has said unequivocally and repeatedly that this shouldn't be an issue. Fortunately, there are current and former officials in the West that that understand that, you know, maybe now isn't the time to discuss this issue. Maybe you discuss it a little on down the line and really slay the wolf nearest the sled here in terms of getting done what the lowest hanging fruit is, because frankly, there isn't that much low hanging fruit, and the negotiations are tough enough as is. Mm-hmm. So the missile issue is real, but there are people that are overhyping it, I think.
Right. All right. Now, so the Iraq reactor, that is the one that produces, that can produce weapons grade plutonium as a byproduct, even though they do not have the very fancy facility that they would need to reprocess it as such, and even though they have a deal with the Russians to take care of any waste material out of there. I think that's the situation going into this negotiation. But so what's at dispute about Iraq in the negotiation, Reza? Can you tell me?
Well, I think that originally the dispute centered on the fact that Iran didn't need a heavy water facility to you know, help produce energy and produce other peaceful measures within its program, broadly conceived, right? And the Iranians said, well, if we want to, we can, but if this is a concern for you, there are ways to reconfigure the facility without shutting it down, without mothballing it, so that it does not run the same kind of proliferation risk that Western countries had originally perceived. That's something that the Iranians have on numerous occasions stated that they're amenable to doing, and that's what they're in the process of negotiating now. So they've actually made progress on the issue from where we were 6 months ago. Right. And frankly, it's a facility that hasn't even been fully constructed yet.
Right.
So we're talking about something that's in the offing.
Right.
But the Iranians have given their negotiators quite a bit of leash in terms of trying to provide enough flexibility to get this thing done. And so too has the United States. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think that it's not fully understood to the degree that it should be here that, you know, yes, the United States is negotiating, but so is Iran. Like, this succeeds if both sides compromise, and it fails if one side isn't willing to compromise. So if it's gotten this far, I think we need to give both sides credit and encourage them to continue so that that failure is less and less a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and now what about the facility at COM, the Fordo facility, where they had been doing at least some of the enriching, or was it all of the enrichment up to 20%? U-235 was taking place at COM. What's its future, and how much of it is up for negotiation?
Well, this is what they're parsing through right now. Originally, the United States wanted Iran to shut down this particular facility because it was buried underground and it was much less able to be bombed, for lack of a better term, right? And the United States probably has bunker busters that could get it, but, you know, that's neither here nor there because the United States doesn't want to drop bunker busting bombs on Iran. The Iranians said, we're not going to close this facility. What we can do is open it up to inspections, increase the verification mechanisms that are in place so that the International Atomic Energy Agency can see what's going on in the facility, and we can negotiate over what the actual construct of the facility will look like. Will it be a research and design facility? Will it be a uranium enrichment facility? What does that look like? That's what they're negotiating over right now. But I think you've gone from a position that Iran had a little over a year ago, which is nothing about this facility is negotiable, to today, where they're actually negotiating what it's going to look like in the future, that's progress. So,
right.
Again, flexibility should beget flexibility, and that's why we're almost 6 months in and making progress, not understanding that it is a very tough negotiation process any way you slice it.
Right. All right, and now, so I brought up 2005 before, and you know, I guess in my impression, the Iranians were really hoping that they could get a deal, although I don't think they were being, you know, fools about it when the Bush administration refused to participate in the negotiations at all, but just sent the so-called E3, Britain, France, and Germany, to negotiate on their behalf and all of that. But I guess, you know, it was pretty obvious at the time for any of us cynics that, you know, the E3 can't get a deal without American support, and so there's not going to be a deal here, and so this is all... You know, it's like the Israeli-Palestinian talks or whatever. Like, yeah, we're going through this again, but nobody really even believes at the beginning that it'll go anywhere at the end. So I just, and this is more of a speculative sort of gut feeling sort of a question for you, Reza, is just whether you really think that the political establishments, which is oversimplifying it, of course, there are different factions in both countries and all, but whether you think that the, you know, major force with the political establishments in each country really want to see this thing through this time, or whether, you know, there's still kind of that, you know, residue of just, it's all just a charade, it's the same old American BS.
Well, I don't think this is the same old American BS if we're referencing the Bush administration for comparison. You know, what the Obama administration...
Well, or Obama. I mean, Obama pretended to outcome 4 days after they declared it in order to scotch his own push for negotiations back in 2009 and that kind of thing. So he hasn't... And after the Turkish and the Brazilians, when they did exactly what he asked to try to strike a deal, he then denied it and screwed them over back in 2010, and you know...
Yeah, well, there's enough blame to go around. You know, we could sit here and put together a laundry list of missed opportunities that Washington and Tehran have pissed away. But looking forward, which is what I think we all should do, we have a very real opportunity. You know, the Obama administration has taken steps that no previous American administration since 1979 has taken. And the Iranians have taken steps that no previous Iranian administration has taken. Yeah, sure. You know, the dustbin of history is littered with missed opportunities. That's one of the great tragedies of U.S.-Iran relations over the past three decades. We finally have a very real chance, fragile as it might be, to overcome the obstacles that have been in, you know, preventing us from finding a peaceful solution to the
Reza,
conflict.
Reza, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the work that you're doing, you and Trita and the rest of them. It's niacouncil.org. Thanks again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richmond, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richmond, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today, corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson, available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org.